Broadcasting from the Republican National Convention in St. Paul, Minnesota, this is Free Speech Radio News. It's Wednesday, the 3rd of September, 2008. I'm Aura Bogado with Leanne Caldwell. On today's newscast, we'll continue our coverage of events both in and out of the Republican National Convention. We'll head to nearby Minneapolis and hear from Ron Paul's shadow convention. And we'll check in with New Orleans and the impact of Hurricane Gustav on small businesses trying to make ends meet.
We'll also go to the headlines shortly. But first, Senator Joe Lieberman of Connecticut, former Democrat and one-time vice presidential nominee, praised Republican John McCain at the GOP convention. Lieberman became an independent after he lost his primary election race in 2006. He is close friends with McCain and has similar hawkish beliefs on foreign policy. Lieberman derided Democratic candidate Barack Obama.
Senator Barack Obama is a gifted and eloquent young man who I think can do great things for our country in the years ahead. But my friends, eloquence is no substitute for a record, not in these tough times for America.
We'll have more later in the newscast on tonight's featured speaker, Sarah Palin, as well as sounds from the streets. That after this news.
I'm Shannon Young with the headlines. NATO helicopter gunships based in Afghanistan conducted a cross-border raid into Pakistan's tribal belt early this morning, killing what locals say was up to 20 civilians in multiple house raids. Afridi Afridi reports.
The helicopter dropped NATO soldiers into at least three villages in South Waziristan to carry out a search operation for suspected Taliban insurgents. One eyewitness says the soldiers went inside of specific houses and shut those inside. Women and children are among the 20 people killed in the operation. It was the first confirmed incursion into Pakistan by NATO troops stationed across the border in Afghanistan. A few hours later, two bullets were fired into the car of Prime Minister Syed Yusuf Raza Gilani. The car was empty on its way to pick up the Prime Minister. A Taliban spokesman in the Swat Valley claimed responsibility for the shooting. The Pakistani military claims to have killed 30 Taliban militants in Swat today as part of an ongoing operation. The shooting attack on the Prime Minister's convoy comes just 3 days ahead of Pakistan's presidential elections. For FSRN, I'm Afridi Afridi.
Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice has announced a $1 billion aid package for Georgia, ostensibly to help rebuild housing and infrastructure damaged when Russian troops rolled into Georgia last month. Vice President Dick Cheney is touring the region this week to meet with the leaders of Georgia, Ukraine, and Azerbaijan. The administration's focus on the region comes as the U.S. ambassador to NATO has called on the organization's members to show Russia that it's serious in defending Baltic states in the event of an attack. Naomi Fowler reports from London.
The U.S. ambassador to NATO, Kurt Volker, says that failure to prepare to act in defense of Baltic states undermines NATO's credibility. He suggests staging military exercises in the former Soviet states, but, quote, not in a provocative way. Recently joined European member states and NATO members Estonia, Latvia and Lithuania sit uncomfortably close to the situation in Georgia. These Baltic states gained independence from the Soviet Union in the early 90s and are publicly critical of Russia. Article 5 of the NATO treaty says that an armed attack against one or more members shall be considered an attack against them all. But while the European Parliament has condemned what it calls Russia's unacceptable and disproportionate military action, many European NATO members depend heavily on Russian oil and gas. Yet Georgia is key to an alternative energy route which would allow the EU to reduce its dependency. Today's EU resolution recommends the EU Commission offer Georgia all necessary assistance to protect that energy infrastructure. This is Naomi Fowler in London for Free Speech Radio News.
Former university professor Sami Al-Aryan has been released from jail after a federal judge ordered the government to justify Al-Aryan's continued detention. The Palestinian academic has been accused of providing material support to Islamic Jihad. an organization on the State Department's terror watch list. A jury did not find him guilty on any of the charges, but the government refused to release him. His family filed a habeas corpus appeal to challenge his detention. Al-Aryan was released to the custody of his daughter yesterday, while he awaits a trial for his refusal to testify before a grand jury in a separate case. The Nigerian military has arrested an American filmmaker working on a documentary about the Niger Delta region and transferred him to the federal capital, Abuja, for further interrogation. Samuel Okoya reports from Lagos.
Award-winning documentary filmmaker Andrew Berings and his Nigerian interpreter were arrested last Sunday while filming in the Niger Delta region. Nigerian authorities confiscated Berings' equipment and passport during his arrest. The Paris-based group Reporters Without Borders alleged that Berens and his interpreter were given no food and very little water and were subjected to repeated interrogation that prevented them from sleeping. Both men could potentially face charges of spying, an offense that carries the death penalty in Nigeria. A number of Nigerian human rights lawyers have offered to defend them in court. In the last 2 years, the Nigerian government has kept a tight control on news flow from the Niger Delta region after insurgents fighting for a share of oil proceeds heightened their activities. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Sam Olukoya in Lagos.
And those are the headlines. I'm Shannon Young.
This is FSRN, broadcasting today from the Republican National Convention in St. Paul, Minnesota. Aside from the delegates, politicians, and press here at the RNC, dozens of different groups organized protests this week in the Twin Cities, and for some, not everything is going according to plan. That was the case last night for the Poor People's Economic Human Rights Campaign's March for Our Lives. The sound system didn't work, attendees were snatched out of the crowd and arrested, one was tasered, and the police kept forcing changes to the march route. But the campaign went ahead with their rally and a marathon march. Tanya Snyder was there for all the ups and downs and has a story. Tanya?
Thanks, Aura. While some Republican convention delegates spent their day at the Day of Fun and Fashion at the Mall of America, in Mears Park, the Poor People's Economic Human Rights Campaign brought together some 800 people. Women on welfare, families who've lost their housing, disabled people without adequate health care, and supporters of all stripes. Minnesotan Roger Cuthbertson flew a rainbow-colored kite that said, "Ningún humano es ilegal." No human being is illegal. The crowd chanted along with the organizers.
We're gonna move up and out of poverty now. We're gonna move up.
The group's March for Our Lives has a central theme: to accuse the Republicans, and the Democrats for that matter, of violating their economic human rights.
This is our time. It's our time to end hunger. It's our time to end homelessness, and it's our time to end unemployment. It's our time to stop the war in Iraq and bring that goddamn money home.
Campaign leader Sherry Honkala has been arrested twice in the course of the last few days as she and her group established a tent city called Bushville, modeled on Depression-era Hoovervilles. At Bushville, activists provide a makeshift home for poor and homeless people during the convention. During the rally, police grabbed a young woman out of the crowd and placed her under arrest. No one understood why, but organizer Lisa Fithian explains that this is a tactic the police have been using in St. Paul.
What we've been seeing here is that the police have been filming and videographing everything. They're reviewing tapes. When they find somebody that they think they want, they send in snatch squads to grab them. They have enormous reinforcements of riot police, police on horse, so once the snatch is made, they quickly move those forces in to create a big circle and perimeter around them, escalating the situation radically.
Another activist was tased and arrested. There were reports of at least two more arrests, bringing the convention week's total to more than 300 arrests. During the confrontation and then during the march, lines of riot police with gas masks and heavy artillery regularly confronted activists. A local onlooker assessed the weaponry.
They're gas cans, there's gas masks, less than 9mm. Then they got an automatic airsoft gun. That is a high-powered mace, basically a pepper spray. The other things are tear gas.
The Poor People's Economic Human Rights Campaign led hundreds of people on a 40-block march past the Ramsey County Jail, where several inmates have died in the last few years for lack of medical care. A few blocks from the RNC Convention Center, the march passed the state capitol, where a day-long music festival was being abruptly shut down by police, just as Rage Against the Machine was going to play a surprise set. The lead singer of Rage was arrested, and the crowd joined the Poor People's March and headed with them down to the site of the RNC. Sherry Honkala and a few others brought a citizen's arrest warrant for crimes against humanity and a flag to the Republicans inside the convention center and left without being arrested. The crowd stood around not knowing what to do until someone announced there was tear gas down on Wabasha Street, and everyone headed toward Wabasha Street. Finally, 5 hours after the beginning of the rally, the crowd was met with another line of riot police, which announced that the crowd was now an unlawful assembly and issued an order to disperse. For FSRN, I'm Tanya Snyder at the Republican National Convention.
Chow, 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 we are marching for liberation. We want revolution now. We are the workers, and we are marching. Bella chow, bella chow, bella chow, chow, chow. For liberation, we have revolution now.
There was another political gathering in the Twin Cities, the Ron Paul Revolution. An estimated 10,000 people, many traveled from around the country to hear Paul speak at their own convention in downtown Minneapolis. His emphatic supporters nearly filled an NBA basketball arena. The nine-hour event culminated in an address by Ron Paul, their leader, the former Republican presidential candidate and congressional member from Texas.
I was skeptical. Some said that you were apathetic and we helped remove that, but I lost my skepticism. I hope you lost your apathy.
Paul's supporters are disenchanted with the two main political parties and the political system. His movement gained traction on the internet during his presidential bid and ballooned into more than 1 million votes in the primary and a war chest of $35 million. Often mocked at debates by fellow Republican candidates, Republicans associate Paul with the fringe. He was not invited to speak at the Republican convention.
I did not want to run people's lives. I did not want to run the economy, and I did not want to run the world.
Paul's anti-war, anti-interventionist, anti-immigrant, pro-privacy, and pro-small government beliefs strike a chord with his followers. But his biggest applause of the night comes when he talks about getting rid of the Federal Reserve.
The Fed.
Very impressive. And yet nobody in Washington knows that you even exist. But they will.
Republicans have failed to embrace Ron Paul. For example, a bitter battle between Ron Paul delegates in Nevada and the Republican Party resulted in a lawsuit that allowed only a fraction of the Ron Paul delegates to attend the Republican convention. Paul's three-day shadow convention launches off the next stage of the movement, the Campaign for Liberty. John Tate is the executive director.
We're talking about really organizing their local precincts and counties and states, recruiting members to Campaign for Liberty, getting them active, lobbying on issues in their localities and states and at the federal level, providing them the tools they need to get the politicians to vote correctly and to do the right thing, and also the tools they need to hold them accountable if they don't.
Ron Paul will not be on the ballot in November. Paul has no plans to endorse Republican John McCain, nor Libertarian candidate Bob Barr, nor Constitution Party candidate Chuck Baldwin. His supporters ponder a second choice.
So when it comes to November, I'm going to write in Ron Paul's name. And I know there's a lot of people who are going to do that as well.
Right now, I'm vacillating between Bob Barr and Chuck Baldwin.
Oh, you're assuming I even vote anymore.
Among a sea of Ron Paul t-shirts, signs, pins, and painted skin at his events, the revolution is still about Ron Paul.
Thanks, Leanne. Back at the RNC, tonight's big-ticket speaker is Alaska Governor and Vice Presidential candidate Sarah Palin. And although she's running as McCain's VP, during an MTV interview last year, Palin supported former Republican candidate Ron Paul. Add to that controversy the fact that Palin's 17-year-old unmarried daughter is pregnant, Palin's questionable fundraising for her political campaigns, the solicitation of large amounts of federal earmarks, accusations of cronyism, and her husband's association with a group that wanted to secede from the United States. But pro-lifers got a shot in the arm with Palin's nomination, and it's solidifying their support for John McCain. Karen Miller has been at the RNC this week gathering responses from some of those staunch pro-lifers.
Protesting on the steps in front of the Cathedral of St. Paul in downtown St. Paul, members of the anti-abortion group Operation Rescue carry signs that they hope do not mince words. Mary Kelch from Caledonia, Minnesota, is carrying one of them.
A vote for Obama is a vote for a dead child.
The group went to the DNC in Denver, and now they're at the RNC as part of a national campaign to tell Catholics not to support Obama and Biden. In this presidential election, anti-abortion groups like Operation Rescue have been the hardest for John McCain to court. All that has changed, however, with McCain's vice presidential nominee, Sarah Palin. Randall Terry is president of Operation Rescue. Terry says that earlier rumors of a possible pro-choice running mate for John McCain, like former Pennsylvania Governor Tom Ridge or Senator Joseph Lieberman, were just a political ploy.
They threw it out so that the pro-life community could howl and complain, and then he could pick the woman he intended to pick all along, and he could look like a hero. And it worked. It was great political strategy on his part. Float something you have no intention of doing so that you look like you're listening to the cry of your party. I mean, let's face it. If Senator McCain had chosen a pro-choice running mate, it would have made the Republican Party implode.
Former pro-choice presidential candidate Mike Huckabee agrees. He talks about what Palin's nomination does.
First of all, satisfy that concern among the conservatives that he truly is planning to have an administration that reflects the best values of the country and the base of the Republican Party. He has done that with Sarah Palin.
For Free Speech Radio News at the Republican National Convention in St. Paul, Minnesota, I'm Karen Miller.
There's been a lot of speculation regarding Palin's nomination. I spoke with Ramona Oliver. She's the communications director for Emily's List. Her group asked women around the nation what they thought about McCain's pick.
They very much saw this as a political choice rather than one in which McCain felt that she had the experience and qualities to make a good vice president. And it's the exact opposite when it comes to the Obama-Biden ticket. When we asked these women, did the nominee pick their vice presidential candidate because he believes his choice has the experience and qualifications, or he made his choice out of political considerations, about 60% of women felt that John McCain picked Sarah Palin because of political considerations, while 50% of voters felt that Barack Obama had chosen Joe Biden because he had the experience and qualities to make a good vice president.
Mike Huckabee says that Palin's nomination is moving women forward. Does it, in your opinion? Will it really help women?
Well, if you ask women voters out there, no. In fact, as we talked to these women in this survey, the more they got to know about Sarah Palin, the less likely they were to feel that this was the ticket for them. And in the end, 53% of these women voters felt that the Obama-Biden ticket is a better leadership, a better set of leaders to understand the issues and concerns that are important to women, while only 35% of voters felt that way about the McCain-Palin ticket. McCain put, you know, a lot of motivations are ascribed to McCain choosing Palin for this ticket. He wanted to reinstitute his maverick status. He wanted to appeal more to women, and he wanted to appeal particularly to Hillary Clinton voters. And as you will see, anyone can go to our website to read the study that came out today, he failed on all of those points. Women see this as a blatantly politically motivated choice. Once voters have learned more about Governor Palin, they are far less likely to vote for John McCain. And amongst Clinton voters, 55% of those Clinton voters said that they were less likely to vote for John McCain after hearing about Governor Palin.
Ramona Oliver is the communications director for Emily's List. Sarah Palin is scheduled to address the delegates tonight. Stay with us this week as we continue our convention coverage. Now we move on to news from the Gulf. Leanne?
After Hurricane Katrina hit in 2005, lack of revenue forced big and small businesses alike to close their doors for good. The tourism industry also faltered, and thousands of people lost their jobs. Now, Hurricane Gustav could deliver more setbacks to a city trying to rebuild its economy. FSRN's Dolores M. Bernal is in New Orleans and files this report.
Hurricane Gustav's visit to the Gulf of Mexico region has been an economic nightmare for many small businesses in New Orleans that were looking forward to tourists and events like Southern Decadence, an annual festival that attracts a crowd of 250,000 gay men from across the country on Labor Day weekend.
I think they lost a lot of money, millions.
Paul Baker, a resident in the French Quarter, believes that the city simply cannot afford to have any more storms like Gustav and Katrina because their impact in the $8 billion tourism industry that the city needs to keep afloat comes to an abrupt halt.
Well, a lot of people are going under. Like on Royal Street, a lot of the art galleries have closed up, so, and they have no business.
Nancy Bender leases land to small businesses in the Quarter. She's had a lot of turnover from tenants that have closed their doors due to the economic downturn. She says that even car dealerships, manufacturing jobs, and big corporations like Chevron are leaving New Orleans.
Of course, it's unfortunate, and I know New Orleans Center is closed, and that was pretty much a mainstay down there. We shop there all the time. A lot of big businesses did leave. I think they should come back. However, as a resident, these hurricane scares after Katrina are quite serious, and I think a lot of people are reevaluating how many more times they want to go through this.
After Hurricane Katrina hit in 2005, the New Orleans region lost an estimated 230,000 jobs, according to the U.S. Labor Department. People who lost these jobs turned to social services and unemployment to survive until new jobs became available. Michael Walde says that those in the Lucinan are the residents of New Orleans and their families.
Companies moving out, they're going to establish their job somewhere else, but the people that who live is here, that's who suffers afterwards.
Rolando Carrillo also agrees. Carrillo works at a hotel off Bourbon Street. He believes that finding a good-paying job won't be easy after the potential negative impact of a storm like Gustav.
Well, it's going to be really, really difficult because, they was not recuperating yet from Katrina after 3 years. And now the hurricane Gustav and now Hannah, okay, it's terrible.
Reporting from New Orleans, Dolores M. Bernal, Free Speech Radio News.
In Ecuador's Amazon rainforest, a coalition of residents and indigenous nationalities are suing U.S.-based oil company Chevron Texaco. They say that 30 years of the company's oil exploitation has resulted in severe environmental and health damages in the region, including 428 cancer deaths. A recent report issued by a court expert determined that Chevron might have to pay up to $16 billion in damages. FSRN's Daniel Denver traveled to the Ecuadorian Amazon to file this story.
The Cofan, an indigenous nationality in Ecuador's Amazon rainforest, have largely abandoned their centuries-old livelihood, hunting and fishing. Among dozens of other complaints, Cofan leader Emergildo Criollo says he lost two of his children to diseases related to oil contamination. Criollo and others in the Amazon blame the U.S. oil company Texaco, now part of Chevron.
As a Cofan nationality, we live above the river Aguarico. We didn't have a fixed place to stay as a community. We walked around moving up and down. This is our tradition, to live moving around, going all over the place. Since Texaco arrived, we no longer have this tradition. With the company's arrival, colonization began, colonizing all of us here in the Amazon.
Now the Amazon Defense Front, a coalition of farmers, residents, and indigenous peoples in the Ecuadorian Amazon, is suing Chevron in a provincial Supreme Court, claiming that Texaco caused a, quote, Amazonian Chernobyl of pollution during their 30 years of activity in the country. The Amazon Defense Front charges that Texaco's refusal to invest in basic environmental safeguards led to the dumping of billions of gallons of toxic wastewater into the rainforest and its waterways, causing widespread ecological damage and pollution-related illnesses. Amazon Defense Front President Herman Chavez says that the government and Texaco classified large swaths of rainforest as vacant land as a way to dispossess local residents.
What does vacant land mean? It means land that belongs to no one. So if it is no one's land, I do what I want, do what I feel like, right? And then there was also the issue of less investment, larger profits. It's clear that Texaco, instead of doing the treatment and reinjecting the water, of treating the perforation mud, got rid of it and dumped it into the ecosystem. And the consequences have been fatal.
From 1972 until 1992, Texaco dumped over 18 billion gallons of toxic wastewater into large, unlined, open pits, many the size of Olympic swimming pools. A court-appointed expert recently determined that Chevron might have to pay damages of up to $16 billion to remediate environmental contamination and compensate residents for healthcare and other costs. Maria Ana Jimenez moved to Lago Agrio 37 years ago from Loja and was one of the first locals to start organizing residents against oil contamination. Jimenez says that when residents began to complain of oil-related illnesses, the company would respond that the land belonged to Texaco, not to Ecuadorians, and that they should go back to the highlands if they did not like it. Jimenez and many others also charge that Texaco told residents that oil could not cause illnesses and was actually medicinal.
For there to be water, for there to be healthy people, we'll bring water from above, from the Due River, where there is no contamination. But with what money? We'll put a hospital where the people can go and where the people can get their illnesses treated, but there's no money. And all of us, we all need Texaco to take responsibility and pay for the damage they caused in the Amazon so that funds can be reinvested right here.
The recent report by the court-appointed expert has backed residents' claims, finding that Texaco's dumping of formation waters, the toxic mixture that results from oil drilling, has seriously harmed the highly biodiverse ecosystem and caused scores of illnesses, including at least 428 deaths from cancer. Chevron claims that a 1998 agreement with the government of Ecuador frees the company from all legal responsibility. In the agreement, the government certified that Texaco had remediated contaminated sites. Activists from Amazon Watch, a U.S. organization supporting the lawsuit, note that the agreement was between Texaco and the government and is irrelevant to the class action lawsuit on behalf of 30,000 individuals. Furthermore, they say that Texaco cleaned up less than 1% of contaminated land. Chevron did not respond to repeated interview requests. The case has received increasing international media attention, and Chevron has responded with a large-scale public relations and political pressure campaign. A recent article in Newsweek revealed that Chevron is running a high-powered lobbying effort in Washington, urging the Bush administration to drop trade preferences for Ecuador if the government does not intervene in the case. Chevron's lobbying team includes former Republican senator from Mississippi, Trent Lott, and fundraisers close to Arizona senator and presumptive Republican presidential nominee, John McCain. In a recent surprise move, Ecuador's President Rafael Correa has offered to mediate the case, and Chevron has indicated that it might be willing to negotiate an out-of-court settlement with the plaintiffs. Activists say that Chevron may be seeing their chance for a legal victory to be fading. From Lago Agrio in the Ecuadorian Amazon, this is Daniel Denver for Free Speech Radio News.
You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News, which is supported by Pacifica Radio, community radio affiliate stations, and listener supporters. You can send us your feedback. Just drop us an email to comments@fsrn.org. That's comments@fsrn.org. Our newscast is produced by Catherine Comp and Vinod K. Joes. Thanks today to Christian Schwartz. Our headlines editor is Shannon Young, and our tech team at KPFA in Berkeley includes Rose Katapchi and Oscar Hernandez. Our interns are Robert Loza and Peter Steen. From the Republican National Convention in St. Paul, Minnesota, I'm Aura Bogado with Leanne Caldwell. Stay tuned this week for continued coverage from the RNC.